Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Just head to amazon.com/adfreetruecrime to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We acknowledge the Yuggera and Kaurna nations as traditional custodians of the land on which we work, live and learn, and their continuing connection with the land, waters and community. We pay our respects to them and their elders past and present.
All content related to this program is for general informational purposes only and contains stories and discussions around mental health that may be disturbing to some listeners. If you are concerned about yourself or someone you know, please seek professional individual advice and support. More details are contained in our show notes.
There's enough people who are going to tell you you're shit in the world without you doing it to yourself, you know? So you really do have to just, you know, as RuPaul would say, you got to love yourself, honey.
That's comedian, author, educator and broadcaster Nellie Thomas. And this is Reframe of Mind,
where we create a safe space to deep dive into discussions about mental health, joined by some of Australia's leading minds to expand our understanding of the world and ourselves.
Because we don't exist in a vacuum, and the way we talk about mental health shouldn't either.
We're your hosts, Louise Poole and Andy LeRoy.
Last time on Reframe of Mind, we talked about creating our own community or board of directors to make sure we're getting the right level of encouragement and support in the things we do.
But what if that support that we think we need is actually being influenced by other people's perceptions of what we need, and it's not actually that support that's truly going to help us fly?
Yeah. So this is kind of pertinent because as we continue our own personal journeys, you and me.
Yeah, Andy and Louise.
Andy and Louise, Louise and Andy.
Coolaroy, as we tried to call ourselves in the early incarnation.
Yeah, that was a great branding exercise. But, you know, we're revisiting how we relate to other people and, you know, we're trying to build a business where we want to amplify the voices of the people and the causes that get overlooked. So there comes a point where we've got to ask ourselves if we're actually in the right headspace to be doing that.
Yeah, you can't help anybody else until you help yourself first, isn't it? It's like, it's when that why they say, you know, take the oxygen mask for yourself first.
And if we try and do the same thing as every other media company, then we're probably just going to end up doing the same thing as every other media company and those voices will still get ignored.
So this is a good point to kind of ask ourselves if we are in the right place at the moment to authentically claim who we are and actually be living the values that are important to us.
Because if we're living our lives to please other people, we're not really doing ourselves much service at all, are we? Mm. We're just running on that same treadmill, serving other people's values while minimizing or even completely invalidating our own.
And Andy, you know how much I hate treadmills.
I'm sure you're not alone.
We are not a pro-treadmill podcast. Let's put it like that. So this episode, we're going to speak to the woman who helped us find strength in knowing our full selves, warts and all, and shared her story with us, Australian comedian Nellie Thomas.
Yeah. Nellie is an Australian comedian, author, educator and broadcaster. And before her award-winning career in stand-up comedy began in 2002, it doesn't really sound that long ago, but it's a while back.
Oh, it feels like a very long time ago now.
Man, before then.
You know, people born in 2000 are like 22 now.
Nellie worked in the welfare sector before that, and she continues to advocate in the areas of homelessness, asylum seeker rights, gender and women's rights.
You might have heard her voice on ABC Radio or on her podcast, Person, Place, Thing. Or you could have picked up one of her books where she tackles issues around belonging in her very accessible and funny style.
When we recorded this interview, Nellie's fifth book, Some Mums Are Fat Moles, was pending release. And given it was released in May 2021, you can see what an unexpected but valuable journey Reframe of Mind turned out to be for us. And this conversation with Nellie was for me anyway, one of those pivotal conversations as we continued our growth journeys.
Given the climate around the time with cancel culture, we started by asking Nelly her opinion about what place taboo subjects have in comedy.
Any taboo subject is served well by good comedy, you know. So I think a lot of the work that I've done in a range of difficult spaces, including mental health, has benefited from humour. Mind you, I mean, as I'm sure we'll probably get into, you kind of got to know what you're doing as well. Like, you can venture into difficult territory and cause a mess, really, make a big mess. But I think if it's done well, then those sort of discussions are really opened up with laughter.
I think the fact that you said you suffered from chronic anxiety and depression is what allows you to own that space, and also allows me to relate to that, because that story is the same for me, as I'm sure it is for a lot of other people too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing. Once you start talking about things like that, you realise, and this has been quite a revolution, hasn't it, in mental health in the last decade. The more you talk about it, the more people will tell you, oh, me too, you know. So it's another example. I hope it's not a weird analogy, but I had a couple of miscarriages when we were trying to have children, and it wasn't until I started telling people that I'd had a miscarriage that I realised how common it was. You know, so many women I knew had had miscarriages that I didn't know about. And I think mental health is the same. It's sort of the openness begets openness, if you know what I mean.
What do you think the best method is for you to actually get permission from the audience to go there?
Well, I think it's something that Louise touched on. I personally think you have to be from that group yourself, or you've got to be very, very, very careful. Like, I would be very cross if I, and I've been in this position, having been a comedian for 20 years, I've been in the audience where I've heard people crack jokes about depression who have never experienced depression or any other mental health issue, and I do not like it. So I think you have to have, I mean, lived experience is an overused phrase, isn't it? But it's true. I think you have to have some lived experience. That might not be directly yours. Like, I know a couple of great comedians who had parents who suffered depression, for example. You know, personally, I'm okay with that. That's their experience. They're still affected by it. But the other thing is, I think you have to be in a good space. So getting up and talking about depression, if you're in a depressive episode, I think is not a good idea at all. Like, the stage isn't for therapy.
That was one of my questions, actually, whether you find that sometimes the process can be triggering rather than, I guess, helpful, or whether it combats or triggers sometimes what you're feeling.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting thing. I reckon when I was lucky in the sense that when I started comedy, I was 28, which in comedy terms is old, you know, and I'd already worked and had career and stuff like that. So I had a little bit of maturity behind me. But even for me, I think I was sort of too open too fast. And I got to the age of about 35. I think I'm nearly 47 now. I got to the age of about 35. There were some things from my past that I had been joking about, which went really well, like were great stories or great bits, and people loved them and they related to them. But I had this sudden realization that they were harming me, you know, that seeing people laugh effectively at my pain wasn't therapeutic in the way that I thought it was. And so I stopped doing them, you know. And I think if you've got enough confidence in your ability, then you can say, I will find the funny elsewhere. You know, I'm talented enough, whether you're a writer or a comedian, a musician, whatever. I do not subscribe at all to the suffer for your art kind of theory. If it is harming you, stop it. So I don't do those bits anymore.
That seems really similar to that kind of message that I got from Hannah Gadsby's Nanette, is to stop making yourself the punchline of jokes, because you're actually worth so much more than that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, at the risk of name dropping, I'm a friend of Hannah's, and, you know, I was there when she started. And though watching Nanette, for me, I mean, it was just an amazing show, but also her exploration of really the psychology of comedy was fascinating, you know, for me as a comedian and a friend, sort of having, you know, I think she tells that amazing story, heartbreaking story about, you know, a homophobic attack that she suffered. And I remember first seeing her do that joke, and you don't hear the end of the story where she gets beaten. You just hear up to the point where it's funny and she's got a witty comeback. And as she quite rightly points out in Nanette, by not knowing the rest of the story, we're kind of let off the hook there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
she takes that pain home. You know, that then sits in her lap. And I think that's a real danger for creative people or anyone who's telling any kind of story. So my way of dealing with that, as I said, with not similar stories to Nanette, but from my own experience, is to kind of go, if I can't make it healthy for me, then don't do it.
Yeah, I think that you're also kind of busting that myth that a lot of people have that it's almost like, oh, if you've got a mental illness, then you can't function, or people who are depressed yes. are always sad, or if you're anxious, all you do is just sit there and, you know, worry about money and grind your teeth. Yes.
Which I do.
I do too. And I pick all my nail polish off as well. I can't yes. leave it on for more than a day. But yes. but that's not all there is to it. Like, you're standing up on stage, you're standing up in front of a room full of people, and you're in front of a bunch of people, which is conquering a whole different kind of fear that people have, people would look at you and maybe not think that there are mental health issues, which
100%
goes to show how much it's everywhere and you can't judge.
Exactly right. And I think there's two parts that I think one of the great things about the openness, and I would say, again, as it's been over the last decade, whether it's footballers or, you know, actors, comedians, politicians, you know, whoever, people who are held up as being sort of confident and competent have kind of come out as having various mental health conditions. And I think that's really helped destigmatize it. One thing I think is difficult, though, and I don't know if this is just me, but I do find it's sort of, a friend of mine refers to it as the curse of the competent woman. Like, people still have trouble believing that I have depression and anxiety because that's not how I present.
Mm.
So I don't know. I've even had that in my personal life. You know, I think if you don't fit the stereotype of the person suffering from depression or anxiety, it can be quite hard to convince people that you're in need.
Can I tell you, I went to, I think, about 10 GPs before I was able to find someone to help me with anxiety and depression.
Oh.
And one is because I am a plus size woman, the automatic yep. thing that they'll say is just go lose weight and exercise and you'll feel better. But two is also they don't listen. I actually saw one GP who I specifically went and asked for a mental health plan, and they said sometimes people just feel sad, go exercise.
Yeah. The amount of times people, I mean, there's so much, you know, there's so much body crap in that, isn't
yes.
there, for a start. Like, that's a whole other thing. But the amount of misdiagnoses in healthcare that come from being plus size person, that's a whole other thing. But this, you know, you will probably love this. One of my favourite jokes I've done about mental health is, what's the first thing people to tell you to do is exercise. You know, you'll feel better and it's great. Yeah, it's not and you won't.
Yeah.
You know, what feels great, sitting on the couch eating cake. So I've done all that. I'm sure you have. Like, there's nothing more infuriating than people telling you what you should do as though you haven't tried everything on earth.
Yeah. And one of the things that I struggled in that list of 10 GPs was because I went in there with my, you know, I suppose, cheery disposition and being, you know, having come from a radio background myself, you're used to putting on this mask
yeah,
where you outwardly present to the world a particular thing and then you go home and cry in the shower at night.
Yeah.
But so they'd say, oh, you don't seem sad. And I would sit there and say, you're seeing me now and I'm putting on this show for you so that I can function.
You know what? It's what I think of as like the Lindy Chamberlain effect. Oh, you mean I'm not presenting as a vulnerable woman? You know, like, I don't do that at the doctor. In fact, side
Especially
note, I do with
them.
My doctor because I've known him for 25 years. You know what I mean? So that I have that relationship with him. But yes, if I had a new doctor or if I'm, you know, talking to finding a new psychologist or something like that, no, I'm not going to sit in the first session and start crying. That's not who I am.
Mm.
You know, it's not how I present. And there's a whole range of sort of gendered assumptions in that too that we've got to get past. Same for men with mental health issues. How many men sit down and start bawling? and going, I just want someone to hug me. You know, not many.
That's a good point. And I've got some family members who are very averse to showing any kind of emotion or, you know, will point the judgmental finger at someone like me who does.
Are you English, Andy? Are you English?
Well, actually, English grandfather.
Yeah, there you go.
So very strong ties to the stiff upper lip, all
English
that kind
and
of stuff.
Australian combo with masculinity. Oh, I feel for
toxic.
You, buddy. I feel for you.
Thank you. I remember in my 20s going to a GP because I was suffering from anxiety and depression at the time. And I said to him, look, I'm feeling shit. I want to get some help, but I don't want to be medicated. I don't feel like I need medication at this point. And I think there are things tied to stigmas around medication around that as well from where I was at the time. But the first thing he did was write a prescription. So at the time, I felt right in that moment that I hadn't been listened to at all, that it was just, here we go, there's your easy fix. Go off and take this and you'll be fine. So I think there's a lot to be said with all of this, how it's since developed, in taking ownership for how you are and how you feel and being able to confidently say, I'm going to get the help that I need.
It's true. I mean, you need a receptive health professional, though, is the other issue. Yeah. You know, like I think there's that, I think some people refer to it as the missing middle. So, you know, in a way, your experience, Louise, and Andy's experience are the polar opposites, aren't they? In, on the one hand, no, you're fine. And on the other hand, here, you need to be medicated. How about we have a consultation that's longer than 5 minutes and we talk about some other options? Like, I'm absolutely not anti-medication. I am on medication at the moment. I'm fine with being on medication. There's no way I was going to get through lockdown without medication with a history of anxiety and depression. So I try and combat that stigma, but I also think it's ridiculous to assume that you just chuck medication at the problem, because it's never going to fix it. It's never going to be the only thing. It's not going to be a magic kind of cure. And there needs to be somewhere in the middle where you go, what's a whole range of strategies that can just give you a little win? You know, and it also depends where you are. I mean, as you both know, I assume if you've had any periods of depression, if you're right in the thick of a really black dog, lay under the table, throw a piece of sausage at me depression, like I can't do anything, you tell me to go out for a jog, you know, you may as well tell me to become a supermodel. That's how realistic it is. You know, like that is just absurd. How about you say, can you aim to have a shower today? You know, let's start there. You're probably going to feel better if you wash your hair. Let's start there, you know. But if you're in a rushed situation or with you, if you're with an inexperienced healthcare professional, they're going to chuck that shit at you. Have you tried yoga? Oh, the amount of people have told me to try yoga. Oh, my gosh. I'm like, now I hate yoga just because you are so annoying, right? So, you know, it's got to be a, I mean, we know this, but we keep failing to do it. It's got to be like a whole of person, whole of environment kind of assessment. What's your family situation like? If you're at school, you know, we say to kids, for example, oh, well, you know, get off your screens and your mental health will be better. Well, what if you're a gay kid and you've been bullied in a homophobic environment? Maybe that environment needs to change.
You know,
like it's not just, it's too individualistic, the discussion.
Even the screen. Like for me, I sometimes find that distraction is what I need. So,
100%.
Yeah, you might say get off your screen, but actually, no, me sitting here for an hour playing solitaire is actually calming me down.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you said that. I have just side note, I have an autistic daughter. And one, you know, she really, her main connection to the world other than her immediate family is via screens. And I've been I'm so grateful for the adult autistic advocates that I've found since she was diagnosed, who kind of basically say these rules about screen time are not made for our kids. You know, she is self-regulating with screens. She's connecting with others. It's a safe space to socialize for, you know, a kid in a way that the school ground isn't. So it's not one size fits all.
Even that conversation around screens and online communities, I mean, think about how far we've come with actually taking the stigma out of having this conversation about antidepressants. I take antidepressants. They've made things much better. I have the space to breathe because of that. But, I mean, being able to form those online communities and find people who have similar life experiences, I mean, screens have made that possible for us.
Oh, 100%. I mean, the same for, you know, being in this situation of being a carer, you know, and particularly during the last 18 months, my God, just so isolated. The main connection I had, and I think one of the things that sustained me really, was online communities, and especially those targeted communities. So, for example, like I'm in the, you know, carer group of local parents of other kids who've got autistic kids, right? So when I tell them something that's happening, they just get it. I don't need to explain. I don't need to justify. I don't need to, they just get it. I feel seen. I feel heard. I feel better. You know, I wouldn't have that without the internet.
Mm. It sounds as though you're finding yourself in positions where you've got more spaces where you can actually be heard now. So rather than in a position where, you know, I think if we looked at society 20 years ago and thought that we could actually survive today with what we had then, we're finding out that we're very poor listeners, we're very poor advocates for each other or anybody but ourselves a lot of the time. But being able to tap into those communities online has really opened up a lot more.
Yeah. And look, it's mixed, isn't it? I mean, obviously, as like someone in my position of some kind of public profile, like, I mean, I've been trolled, you know, like, it's very mixed. And I think, you know, social media can be a revolting place, but then, you know, so can real life humans. So, you know, it's just the same thing, but I guess you're more accessible. I mean, one thing I can't really get my head around is whether this is nostalgia or reality, but I grew up in a little town. You know, my nana had 12 kids. I had over 100 cousins. We were like, you know, walk up the road, ride your bike, go to the pool, kind of see people every day. I really miss that, you know, connection. I don't have anything like that. I've got a good circle of friends and whatever, but people seem a lot busier and more disconnected. But maybe that's just because I'm 47 and not 7. You know, I honestly can't tell.
Yeah, I recently had a visit from a couple of friends. One of them I've known, well, since we were born. She's 3 months younger than me, so we've grown up together. She's more like a sister. Yeah. And the other one we met in kindergarten. But there was definitely a patch in our lives where we lost contact. But the ability to reconnect on social media platforms has brought us back together in that way. But we were like 10-year-olds again when we were actually together a couple of years ago. We were on the scooters, we were down the beach in the middle of winter. It was amazing to reconnect with that energy. So, I think you're on the right thing there. I think maybe, you know, if you're able to reach out to someone from that from that era and grab that energy, go for it.
Yeah, and I think I definitely have found, look, I only got on Facebook a few years ago. I only got on Instagram this year. Like I had some bad experiences on Twitter and just kind of went, ugh, even though I kind of need this for my career, I'm out of here. It's better for my mental health not to be here.
Twitter's really a beast of its own, I think.
Oh, yeah, I'm completely off the tweets. Like too much yelling, too much. And I try not to be reactive, but when I see something that's really upsetting, particularly if I see someone else get bullied, I can't not get involved. So I've kind of pulled back from that. I mean, that has been great, like reconnecting with some old friends and stuff. And I've got friends from school as well. But I miss that rhythm of life where you're going to see a good friend, if not every day, every couple of days.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you really get a sense of how people are traveling mentally. Mm. And I think we just don't, I don't know anyone who has that anymore, you know, other than with a partner or kids.
Yeah. The closest is probably a workplace where you like people, isn't it? But then it's always, it's sad when they, you know, like people leave and then you lose contact and it's never quite the same anymore, or you leave and best intentions of, you know, we'll stay friends forever. It doesn't happen.
Yeah. And maybe this is quite, I could be being very indulgent because I don't have a workplace. Mm. So maybe it's quite specific to me, this sense of isolation. Maybe everyone else is feeling very connected around the water cooler.
I mean, I stopped working in a building around about this time last year, and it's basically just been me and then me and Andy. And it is different. So where I used to see someone or many people every day and have a lot of conversations, now my conversations are our podcast guests and Andy and, you know, my small circle of friends. And I think probably it is a little bit more isolating, but I've also found myself turning more to online communities. Like, I mean, even jumping on things like, I mean, I've got a good community with Instagram, but jumping on things like Reddit, where you can just find other groups of people that share similar interests and discussions. It's not the same though.
Yeah. Is it, when you say it's not the same though, are you missing that physical workplace? Because I mean, I've got other friends who've gone the other way. Like, oh, I'm never going back.
There's things I miss, like people, experiences, random conversations that maybe I wouldn't have thought of, getting to know new people outside my sphere. There's things I don't miss, like toxicity and commuting. Having to listen to people whose opinions I think are shit.
Hell is other people on Zoom. You can just mute them.
Mute, exactly. And we can choose who we talk to in our podcast, so we don't have to talk to people who are racists, right?
That's true. That's right. it's really true. Like this is the dilemma of community, isn't it? You know, it's having grown, as I said, growing up in a little town with a big family. Like I was raised in capital C community. I could not get out of there quick enough. I was so claustrophobic. I could not bear the racism and the homophobia and the sexism and all the isms, all the things, like all the intolerances. I could not. I would have left at 17, you know, as quick as I could. But there's a certain part of me now at this age that really has nostalgia for the connection. But I don't know. As I said, it feels like maybe a fantasy, because I think if I was in an office or in a little town, within 5 minutes I'd be like, I'm out of here. I'm going back to my little home office, you know, and I'd rather feel lonely than enraged.
Yeah. Look, I've actually been working from home now since March last year, and I'm quite happy to be a hermit. It's really lovely. But the odd thing is this week I went to one of those business networking events, which I always hated when I was in other jobs, but actually quite enjoyed it. I met a new friend called Carol. I met some people that, you know, have similar interests. And I think for me, you know, coming into that environment, I suppose as a new business owner as well, doing it for what I needed to, but giving myself that ability to connect with people face-to-face was a real treat. And I think that's hugely, what we're missing with the social media, you know, like I've got family interstate and we keep in touch electronically, but as you say, it's not the same as actually being physically present with them, reading their body language and being able to have a conversation about how things are actually going.
No, it's really different. I felt the same. I did. A friend of mine asked me very carefully and quietly to do a gig for her primary school for Mother's Day, which is, you know, an occupational hazard. And to be honest, I wouldn't have done it except that I owed her a favour. And I was kind of dreading it. And I was like, oh God, you know, like a Mother's Day event. And he said, you know, it won't be well organised. It's a school thing, da da da. Once I got there, I was so thrilled to be in a room with other humans, having not been on stage for a long time, but also just having not been around other adults, you know, for so long. I was beside myself. It's probably one of the best gigs I've ever done, you know, whereas normally I would have dreaded it. I would have absolutely dreaded it. So definitely the whole COVID scenario and, you know, to some extent, having gone through mental health issues and going through whatever, I guess in a way we were better prepared for COVID, you know, because we have a sense of, I mean, I've been isolated before, you know, I've felt like everything was uncertain before. So even though it exacerbated a lot of mental health issues for a lot of people, there was a certain sense of going, what, did you guys not know this shit? Like, no one knows what's going on. That's the world we live in, you know? Like, are you paying attention? Shit's gotten real long before COVID.
I know, right? Just an aside, going back to the Mother's Day gig, though, do you normally say yes to an opportunity and then spend the rest of that day going, oh, is it too late to cancel that? And then when you get there, you actually enjoy it?
Yes and no. I used to, like, I had, like, pathological people-pleasing syndrome, which I think most people with anxiety do. We seem to go into two categories, don't you reckon? It's either, like, get fucked, I'm not even considering it, how dare you, you know, or it's like, absolutely, whatever you want. You know, and I was more in the latter category. But I think once I started mentoring, probably once I had daughters, but also I started doing more mentoring of young sort of female performers, I honestly had one of those, you know, moments where I thought, what am I showing them? What am I teaching these young women that they're bloody, you know, yes women, that they should say yes to everything because that's what you do? I ended up, and even to, you know, gigs that were unprofessional, for example, or where everyone was getting paid except the performer, which is a common occurrence, you know, like how come you can pay the tech guy but not me? That kind of vibe. So,
the exposure. You need the exposure.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm very exposed, Louise.
You can't use exposure to pay the mortgage.
Oh, my Lord. So I end up making myself a rule. Like I picked a couple of charities and they're, you know, issues that are really close to my heart that I'll do free gigs for or cheap gigs for. And then the others I've become actually really good at just going, no.
Yeah. Something you said before about being 17 and getting out of the capital C town as soon as you could. I mean, I think that we're sharing the same story, Nelly, because I at 17, I ran. I was born in Brisbane and I went to Wagga in New South Wales to study at university. So I don't know if I could have got any further away. And I've often looked back at that and thought, I wonder how much of the fact that I couldn't stand some of the homophobia and bullying and sexism, how much of that has driven me to become who I am now.
Heaps.
Yeah, like the fact that I almost became who I am in spite of the people whose opinions that was.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, again, I mean, I guess you have that fork in the road, don't you, where you can kind of dig in and recreate those. I think of them as actually generational traumas.
Mm.
Or you dig in and you go, I don't know if you've both seen that fabulous meme where there's like a mum with a bus and her hands are like pressed against the bus behind her back and it's got like all of these different traumas and her kids are in front of the bus and she's sort of, you know, trying to protect them, you know, from intergenerational trauma. And, you know, I think in that sense, particularly when we talk about mental health, there's no doubt in my mind that my family, extended family, are riddled with undiagnosed mental health issues and that's played a big part in my own mental health journey, if we want to call it that. And I'm sure the same for you too.
Do you think that's something that's driven you towards, you know, writing things like the Some Brains or the Some Girls,
yeah.
you know, like for taking that really hard, I suppose, wanting to right the wrongs in the world stance?
Yeah, absolutely. I will not lie. Like in the most true sense of the word, I think I tell the truth, whether that truth is difficult or not. And I do that because I feel like so much of the anxiety that I grew up with was about repression.
Mm.
You know, it's sort of, you know, you don't air your dirty laundry. I think, well, if you don't air your dirty laundry, we all end up sick.
Yeah.
You know, so my view with my kids is the opposite. I mean, obviously, you got to have boundaries. I'm not going to sit down and go, hey, do you want to hear about the time I lost my virginity? Like, I'm not a lunatic. You know what I mean? But if they ask me, as they do, you know, from time to time, quite confronting things, there's no subject that's taboo. And I won't lie to them about people. So if they get a sense of, I don't care if it's, you know, the postie or your grandma, if they have a view of that person and I agree with it, then I will, in an age appropriate way, say, yes, I think you're right. Rather than going, no, they're lovely. No, not everyone is lovely.
Mm.
Yep. Has honesty always been that easy for you?
That's a good question. Has it always been? I think it's my instinct. I think it's always been my instinct, but I don't, and I reckon anyone who's grown up in a small town will know it's not the prevailing culture, you know. So it felt wrong, to be honest. And I think getting on stage for me and even doing something like talking about mental health, there's no way it would have been acceptable within my family, for example, to sit down at Christmas dinner and say, oh, I've been diagnosed with chronic anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would have been the equivalent of getting up and punching somebody. In fact, punching someone in the face would have been more acceptable. You know what I mean? So getting up on stage and doing that sometimes in front of thousands of people was very liberating. I think it was always my instinct, but it's so not part of the culture of my family and my town that it felt very countercultural for a long time. Not now. Once I hit 40, I'm like, I don't know, zero fucks given.
So
you know what
it's
I mean?
True what they say. 40's the...
Yeah.
Because someone sent me a meme about that the other day because it's my birthday next month and it's a 40th and they're like, oh, it's okay, once you hit 40, you really won't give any fucks then.
Yeah, I think, careful. Well, yeah. How old are you?
Me, I'm turning 50 soon. I'm one of the
oldest. Oh, well, you've been there, sorry. Andy. You've been there.
I have.
Did you have that experience turning 40, or were you already in the honesty is the best policy?
Oh, hell no. No, actually, it's something that I still work on. But I definitely got a lot more courage turning 40 to actually say what I needed to say, because, you know, you kind of have this realization that you are mortal, and that if you don't say it now, well, then you've got less and less time to do it.
Yeah.
For me.
And don't you think as well, by that stage, you're starting to experience yourself, or people around you are experiencing the sort of dissolution of the facades, you know, whether that's people going through divorce, or, you know, kids have issues that you never expected they'd have, or your career didn't turn out to be what it was, or it did, and then that was disappointing, whatever it is, they're kind of, the emperor's got no clothes, you know, and you sort of turn around and you go, what am I doing this pretending for?
Yes.
Yeah.
That is a really good way of putting it.
You know, what is it for? Who is this serving? And I just don't know who it's serving. I feel really sad when I see people still doing that pretending. You know, it's heartbreaking to me.
I think often we run scripts to please people in one way or other. Like you mentioned before about being a big people pleaser. And I think I'd say that I've spent most of my life doing the same as well. But, you know, losing a parent at one point sort of really kind of changed my perspective on that, seeing different people's responses, and then losing my second parent really kind of nailed it home, and I'm nobody's friend now.
Well, I tell you what, one thing I've found going through, you know, different traumatic events has been, even with COVID, you know, not that I'm comparing that to the loss of your parents, and I'm sorry to hear about that, but
it's
like you do sort the wheat from the chaff, don't you? You know, absolutely. You kind of, what is that, what's that quote, the, you know, when people show you who they are, believe them?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when you go through difficulty, I mean, a few years ago I had, my eldest daughter was diagnosed with a chronic illness and my youngest daughter was diagnosed autistic, and neither of those things are tragedies, but geez, they've changed my life and made things difficult in lots of ways. Mm. And seeing how various people respond to those things has been really eye-opening. And I reckon that's also been part of me kind of going, what are you doing all this pleasing for? It doesn't mean they're going to be any more pleasing of you, you know? Like in some cases you're actually seeking the approval of people you don't even like.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you realise that it doesn't matter what you do, you'd never get it anyway.
It's like seeking respect from people you don't respect yourself is literally madness. And I think I didn't really realise that probably until I was about 40 and went through this difficult time with the kids and saw it through their eyes as well. You know, because you think when you go through something big that like everyone who's supposed to will come rushing, and they don't.
Mm-hmm.
That's the truth. Some people come rushing that surprise you. Some people don't come at all. Some people are somewhere in the middle, and you kind of realise, and it doesn't even have to be, oh, now I hate your guts, but you just sort of get a better sense of your true connections to.
Welcome to your 2023 work recap. This year, you've been to 127 sync meetings, you spent 56 minutes searching for files and almost missed 8 deadlines. Yikes. 2024 can and should sound different. With Monday.com, you can work together easily, collaborate and share data, files, and updates. So all work happens in one place and everyone's on the same page. Go to Monday.com or tap the banner to learn more.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite show? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/adfreesports. That's amazon.com/adfreesports to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime members. Some shows may have ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
People.
What would now Nelly say to Nelly, who was starting on that stand-up path How many years ago? 20 years ago, maybe?
Yeah. Oh.
Now that you know what you know, if you had that time machine, you could go back and shake her and go, what's going on?
I'd probably say take less shit. You know, trust your own instincts more. If you feel like, you know, just something as simple as if you feel like when you talk to someone for a gig and it doesn't feel right, it's probably not going to be right.
Mm.
You know, if you feel like it's going to be a schmozzle, it probably is. I've never been wrong. You know, don't do the gig. The other thing I would go back, and this is what I say to younger women that I mentor, you don't work for free.
No.
You know, I don't care if they give you $20. Like, people value, I do actually care if they give you $20, it should be more. Do you know what I mean?
They need to give you more.
People value what they pay for. And unless the caterers, the security, the venue, that everyone else is also doing it pro bono, you don't do it pro bono. And that's as much about your own mental health as teaching them how to treat the next person. Because on a mental health level, when you're doing that stuff, and I did so much of it, you're actually constantly devaluing yourself. And your talent, you know, to kind of go, oh, yeah, it's not that big a deal. No, it's a big deal. How many people can do what you do? You know, you're effectively putting yourself down and then saying, oh, gee, I wonder why my self-esteem's not very good. Stand up, and you can stand up. You're better up standing up and taking the hit when they get cranky.
As Andy and I say amongst each other, sex toys don't pay the bills.
Yes.
On one of my Instagram accounts.
Is that what you're sending me?
No. On one of my accounts, I was approached by a major adult company who asked me to promote masturbation, and they looked at my rate card and only wanted to pay me in masturbatory items. And
oh my Lord.
So we can't take those to the bank and goodness use those gracious. To pay the bills.
Oh, that's a good one.
Just imagine how that conversation would go. Can't pay the bills this month, but plenty of orgasms.
Can you imagine sitting down with I'm trying to think of an equivalent for a live thing, but let's say you were sitting down with a like content developer for a website.
Mm.
Oh, we can't afford to pay you, but we'll send you some dildos. Like, seriously.
It's going to take 2 hours of my time to create this thing, so I better have 2 hours full of straight orgasms to effectively pay for it.
That's worth the big bottle of lube.
And to only send one, extra. I mean.
I better get a lifetime supply for even having this discussion. I mean, it's just, it's so rude. And I think it speaks to the way that Australians devalue arts and culture.
Yes.
But also, like, this kind of people-pleasing side, how self-fulfilling it can be, you know, like if you do actually get on that loop, and I've been on it before, thankfully not now, but you can devalue yourself and what you're bringing, whether that's what you're bringing at work, whether it's what you're bringing to your family, to your friendships, to your neighborhood, to your community, whatever it is. I sort of try and say to my kids in a much nicer way, but I can say it to you bluntly as grown-ups. It's like there's enough people who are going to tell you you're shit in the world without you doing it to yourself.
Yes.
Mm.
You know, so you really do have to just, you know, as RuPaul would say, you got to love yourself, honey.
Amen.
You know? Amen.
Absolutely. It kind of speaks into something else we talk about pretty frequently, is the culture of toxic positivity and, you know, how that can be used against us. You know, like,
Andy,
you ought to be grateful you've got this gig, Nellie. Aren't you grateful?
Lord.
You should show some gratitude.
My poor blessed daughter. I don't talk a heap about my kids, obviously, for privacy reasons, but my darling girl who's 14 has had myalgic encephalomyelitis. Many people will know it as ME/CFS for about 4 years. 4 or 5 years. And the shit that people tell that kid, like, you don't go, you know, exposing all of the profound difficulties of it. But I will say, you know, she missed a couple of years of school. There's been points where she couldn't walk, where she was bedridden, you know, to go from a quote unquote normal life to that has been really difficult. What do people say to her? Oh, a positive attitude will change any situation.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, mate, how do you reckon you'd feel if you were 12 years old and couldn't wash your own hair?
Yeah.
What? You just have to, like, read a nice meme on the internet and you'll feel better.
Just put on a funny movie. It'll be fine.
Oh, just put on a bloody sitcom. Or, well, how about you get a better educational system that copes with kids with different needs?
Mm.
For example, that might keep her connected to other friends. and therefore help with their illness, or, you know, like it, all that stuff ignores the structural, social and cultural issues that feed into illness, whether physical or mental.
It's really interesting you raise that as an example. I've got a friend who lives overseas who's been suffering ME/CFS for some years.
Right.
And it was actually the pandemic that was a bit of a savior for her, believe it or not.
Yes.
Because she's been isolated for so many years.
Yes.
Suddenly all of these online opportunities came up for her to be entertained, and she could go to the theatre staying at home. She could go and see things that she wouldn't normally be able to see.
So true. My beautiful little girl, she was like, so, I mean, you know, of course she didn't want her friends suffering in lockdown, but it'd be like 2 days into being at home doing online school and they'd be tearing their hair out with boredom and frustration. And she's like, well, do you get what I've been going through now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's, if you've got a chronic illness, you are in lockdown of a sort 24/7. And if you've got CFS, sometimes for years, you know, or decades even, and then to have opportunities open up. For example, her high school, which has been fabulous, are now allowing her to do, she does 3 or 4 classes at home and about 5 classes on site. So she's part-time. I don't reckon they would have allowed her to even try that if we hadn't been doing online school because of COVID.
Mm.
Wow.
Because there would have been the reason, oh, we can't set up the tech and the data. And this is a fabulous school, but the systems aren't set up for it. And people naturally are resistant to change. Whereas now we know, oh, actually, no, when for kids with CFS, isn't it great if they can come in even for 1 class a week and see friends and feel part of the community and do some at home, you keep them at school.
Mm.
You know, it's amazing. And to be at, like you said, concerts and whatnot. Lots of things that were said that we couldn't do, we now know we could do, hey.
We heard a similar story from a few weeks ago. We interviewed a woman who is an MS advocate, and she's been living with MS.
Yeah.
And she said a similar thing, like she's been told for decades that they can't accommodate her in a workplace.
Oh, yeah.
And suddenly they can.
Yeah.
And so why didn't they just do this earlier?
Why didn't they just effing do it earlier? Even for me as a carer, I'm like, the amount of work opportunities that I, and I say this, I do not for a second begrudge this, because I would lay in front of that bus for either of my kids. But of course I've had to give up work opportunities for the kids for various reasons. And during COVID, there I am doing, you know, Zoom gigs from my office at home, you know, or dialing in and doing radio spots and things like that I have been told for years we can't do. And so I've just missed out on, you know. So, yeah, it's funny how things can change when the people affected are broader.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I almost want to go so far as to say it's funny how things can change when the white men in charge are affected.
Well, you know, there's some truth in that. No doubt there's some truth in that. Like when people in positions of power, like just watching now, having, because I live in Melbourne, so we've been through, you know, 7,600 lockdowns. And just watching the feds kick into gear in the last week and suddenly start talking about vaccinations and, you know, purpose-built quarantine, all this sort of shit. I'm like, did you guys not know what we've been going through?
Yeah.
Like, what it took this to happen to you to realize how brutal this has been. I mean, particularly for people with mental health, pre-existing mental health conditions, disability community carers and so on. Like, it has been rough, really rough.
How do we change barriers and beliefs to get us all on the same page with things?
Oof, in relation to mental health, you mean?
I think in relation to anything.
Well,
are there things that work? Have you found things that work?
Yeah, I think things do work. I mean, I think I've got probably 2 main life philosophies. One of them is no one wants to think they're an asshole, right? So people are really good, myself included, at talking themselves out of their own inadequacies, or, you know, that's the, oh, I'm not racist, but, you know, like we are very good at convincing ourselves that we're perfect. And so you've got to know that when you're dealing with humans. So I think the best way to approach, I don't care whether it's mental health, whether it's sexuality, whether it's, you know, neurodiversity, whatever the subject, approach it from that point of view. Try not to instill defense. So try not to attack unless you have to. So if I come at you two, for example, and I go, well, I think you're both ableist, and this is why, your first response is going to be, no, I'm not. Like, I know, I tried, or it might at best be, oh, well, I'll need to think about that, you know. Whereas if I can tell you a story about what it's like to be in lockdown, down as, I mean, I can't personally tell you this story, but someone else could, as a person with a disability and what that means, you're far more likely to think, oh, maybe I haven't seen this from that perspective. You know, maybe when I'm, for example, raging about how my business shouldn't be shut down, maybe I look at it from my daughter's point of view, whose life has been upended from a virus that led to CFSME. You know, so if you're a good storyteller and you can, you know, it's charm and disarm, isn't it? Like, get people on side, treat them with respect. The first thing I do, this is such a long answer, but when I do a lot of work in family violence space, and, you know, as I'm sure you both know, that's a very contested kind of area and it's really connected to, you know, gender stereotypes and roles and things like that. The first thing I'll do at a conference in that space is go, put your hand up if you've never said anything homophobic, if you've never said anything racist, if you've never done anything ableist, if you've never, there's no one in the room. Right? All of us have done something that we're not proud of. We might have done it 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So I think you start from the premise that no one's perfect rather than starting from the premise of, I'm going to catch you out.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to show you how much more of a better person I am than you. Yeah. I don't like that. I don't like that at all. It's a terrible activist strategy. It's a terrible strategy for change.
Do you think humour is possibly the best gateway to helping us to open the doors to those conversations that need to happen at the deeper level?
I think, yeah. I mean, of course, being a comedian, I have
loaded
to say
question,
that
sorry.
But I will say, which I alluded to at the beginning, and this sounds like I'm up myself, but I'm going to own it, given what I've said about turning 40. You have to be bloody good at it, you know? Like, don't, you know, we've already talked about Nanette, for example. Like, don't wade into talking, doing jokes about sexual assault unless you're a bloody good comedian and you know what you're talking about and or have experienced it. And probably all three, in fact, you know, not one of those alone is going to carry you through. Don't get up and try and tackle issues that you're not skilled enough to handle. Like, it sounds ridiculous, but I will, at family violence conferences, for example, which I think is one of the reasons why I get booked, I will get the room to laugh.
Mm.
And it sounds like that's impossible. It's not impossible if you understand the sensitive points, you understand the audience, and you treat that audience with respect. But you really want to know what you're doing.
What other charm and disarm strategies do you have in your pocket for helping to bridge that gap and change beliefs?
Oh, Louise, I'm just naturally charming.
I mean,
I was just born with it.
Tell us everything.
Everything. Well, you know what? This is funny. This is where I will say, even though I curse the legacy of people pleasing that I got from all the women in my family, I think I learned it from that.
Yeah.
You know, like, what is people pleasing other than being able to read what people want and give it to them? You know, are my boundaries stronger? Like, if I read from the room that they want what we call in comedy cock and bong, you know, so dick jokes and, oh, I smoked pot last weekend. If I read they want that, will I give it to them? No, I won't.
Yep.
But there is a power in being able to read from both individuals and groups the vibe of the thing and being able to meet that, you know. So I think, to me, that's what charm and disarm is, being able to read what the room needs at that moment. And the moment obviously can change, you know, throughout the day and throughout the event. But it's about, at its base, it's just about being a good listener, I think. You know, it's about actually sitting and listening. So if you're, let's say you're emceeing a conference, for example, actually bloody listen to the person who just spoke and then get up and comment on what they said, instead of having a few pat lines ready to go because it's a finance conference and let's make a joke about, you know, the end of the financial year. Listen to what the person said. How did it feel? How did they feel? What did they say? What were they trying to say? And then if you're connected, I think the audience feels that. Does that sound weird?
No.
Okay,
good.
Interviewing, I suppose we would say the same thing. The best interviews are the ones where you actually listen to what the other person's saying instead of just reading off your pre-approved list of questions.
Yeah.
What does anyone in this world want is just to be bloody seen and heard, you know, and that is all of this stuff. Like, I actually think, to bring us full circle, so many instances of anxiety and depression, I think the root cause of them is not being seen and heard, you know, for who you really are and valued and appreciated, whether that's as a child or in a workplace or in a relationship or whatever it is. It's almost like What is, are you two Sopranos fans?
I haven't watched it, no.
Oh, sorry. God, I love it. Anyway, the psychiatrist says to the mob boss, depression is rage turned inwards.
Very true.
And that's always stayed with me where I've thought, yeah, there's the little girl, you know, like banging on the glass going, will someone fucking listen to me? And that little girl's in a 47-year-old body, you know, so find the people who will listen to you, I guess.
Apart from Nellie Thomas, who would be your most admired comedian?
It wouldn't be Nellie Thomas. If you asked me as a human, I would be in my top five. I wouldn't be in my top five comedians.
Right.
You mean in terms of stand-up?
Yeah. Their ability to connect and you know, do the things that you admire in a comedian.
Yeah. Oh, so many. Who would I pick? Look, I mean, we've already spoken about it. Hannah Gadsby would be one of them. Nanette's one of my favourite shows. Interesting, you know, there's plenty of comedians who argue that it wasn't comedy. I'm like, who gives a shit?
I don't care.
Need to be said.
Oh, my God. You've so missed the point of that show. You need to go watch it again and listen. Yeah. But as a performer, just in general, I actually adore her. I'm a really big fan of Sandra Bernhardt, who, again, I'm not even sure if she would self-describe as a comedian, but she's just a fabulous, provocative, funny, wonderful performer. Of course, since we're talking depression and anxiety, Bill Hicks was one of my favorite comedians. Very dark. I love that dark sense of humor, confronting, challenging on many levels. One of my favorite Australian comedians, in fact, one of my comedians full stop, would be Judith Lucy.
I love Judith,
for the same reason, you know, of being like truthful and vulnerable and honest and all of those sorts of things. Look, anyone who, look, even someone like there's very, I don't know if you two, I presume you've probably heard of Doug Stanhope, who's a really controversial American comedian, and my God, he says a lot of things that I find incredibly offensive. But in terms of the craft, like the skill that he has, and some of the stuff I've seen him do about mental health, absolutely amazing. I saw him the last time I did Edinburgh. He did this fantastic joke. He's like, you know, when you, I probably won't do it justice, but I'll try. It's like, you know, when you lay down at night and you put your head on the pillow and you think, I'm so tired, I'm so tired, I'm about to go to sleep. And what does your brain do? You're a fucking fraud. No one fucking likes you. And he honestly, it went on and on. And a good 5 minutes of him talking about his, you know, negative self-talk. Oh, my God. I can't remember laughing that much in my life, even though he had been so offensive that about a third of the audience had left before that. And I was offended by many of the things he said. Just those sort of moments, you know, I just go, oh, that's gold.
That really kind of speaks also to what we're experiencing with cancel culture as well.
Yeah.
I think as well, doesn't it? So it's such a big
topic. I'm not into it.
No.
I kind of got that with your last comments about having stuck around and appreciated the craft. So
yeah.
I don't know. Where do you think we're going with all of that at the moment?
Look, I think, I mean, there's two sides to it, because I cannot bear, you know, and it's usually guys, no offense, Andy, but it's usually guys, I'm sure you can take it, who sort of stand up, I'm being censored and da-da. I'm like, no, you're not. You're saying what you're saying on a radio show, you know, or on a stage, live at a gig at the comedy festival or on the television or, I mean, your classic is bloody, you know, your Andrew Bolts and your Alan Joneses and whatever, but there's equivalent comedians who talk about being censored when they literally have their own shows. You know, I'm like, you're not being censored. We just don't like you. You know? Seriously. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is this kind of self-righteous moral policing. I cannot bear it. So obviously, because of my book, Some Brains, which, you know, is about neurodiversity for kids, and I wrote it when my daughter was diagnosed and so on, I'm in a lot of spaces. I was a good friend of Stella Young. So I've been around, you know, a lot of disability spaces as but one example. Family violence is another example. You know, these are really hotly contested spaces. And it's true. You know, there are some instances where you go, someone will literally say a person with autism as opposed to an autistic person and they'll be shat on.
Yeah.
And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, that might be a parent who's just received a diagnosis from a psychologist who said, I'm very sorry to tell you, but your child is suffering with autism, and you're expecting them to come up to speed in 24 hours and understand the nuances of the language of autistic culture. Like, get over yourself, seriously.
Yeah.
So I'm not into it. I don't. And this whole, I'll dig back into a tweet that, you know, Nellie wrote in bloody 2002. Yeah. I mean, come on. Like, if there's a pattern of behavior, you know, if you're Bill Cosby, by all means.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's cancel that asshole, you know. But if you are, as we see often with young comedians when they become really successful, oh, he did a joke, you know, about, I don't know, it was, I think it was homophobic. You're like, that guy's gay and he didn't know then, you know, he was 19, he's now 25 or 35. Can we allow some growth? Does he have a history of doing it, or was he just a kid?
Yeah.
You know, it's not just, how is it productive? It just misses the bigger shit that's going on. Talk to me about what you're going to do about the NDIS and not about which word you use to describe my kid.
Yeah.
I can see why you left Twitter, Millie.
You see what I mean?
I can see why you left Twitter.
Because what would happen, someone would get involved. You know, a good friend of mine who's high profile in the media got accused last year of being racist and I defended her. I would do it again. She's a friend. I knew what had happened. I knew the circumstance. Oh, my God. I'm sitting there going, the people who are piling on here, this is a woman who's been in refugee camps, who's dedicated her life to these issues. What do these people do in reality? You know, what are they actually doing in the world? Because when you try and do something, when you try and deal with an issue, whether it's, like I said, family violence, whatever it is, when you write a book about autism for kids or whatever, you are opening yourself up to criticism. And that's okay, but at least I'm fucking doing something.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Nellie, what would you say is in your toolkit day to day to make it through life a little bit easier, I guess?
Oh, you're trying to ask me how I keep my mental health mentally good, aren't you?
Well, I suppose initially it would have been that question, but I was thinking after the whole conversation that we've had, it's probably a broader question than that.
Yeah. Look, I think the big challenge for me, and it's something that I'm getting better at, but that I'm still, I reckon, will be a work in progress for a long time, it's surrender, you know, in the truest sense of the word, of kind of going surrender to what is, accept what is, and work with that. Because I'm one of those people, which is, you know, also the best thing about me and the worst thing about me. Oh, I don't like the way we're talking about autistic kids. I'll write a bloody book about it, and I'll do events, and I'll go on, like, you know, I'll change the world. My child's not gonna, you know. There's also an element I need more balance, where I kind of go, sometimes you have to surrender to what is and not, you know. Lockdown's a good example. As soon as lockdown happened, like this time, like, or March last year, what did I do? I started booking holidays. Right? Like, raging like a little toddler, go booking holidays to Queensland or Bali or bloody wherever I can think to. And of course, that just, the more I fought against it, the more disappointment accumulated as they got cancelled repeatedly and I lost money and all of that kind of stuff. If I'd summoned the maturity to surrender and go, this is what is, work with what is now and work with the good within that, I would have had a better year, you know. And it's a kind of metaphor for life. I think I did it by the end, but my initial impulse is to rage against it.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that you are really passionate about that you want to cover here?
I think the only thing that I always try and say in this space of discussion of mental health is that I think the best thing we can do is just to stop trying to offer solutions and just sit with it. You know, like anyone who, you know, it's a bit like if, as you said, Louise, before, you know, being a plus-sized lady, which I am as well. What is the point of people telling you diet and exercise tips?
I know, right?
I could give you every diet and exercise tip known to humankind that you're missing the point. And it's the same with mental health. Most people, unless they're children, most people with mental health conditions in Australia in 2021 know something at least that they could do to improve their mental health. Not everyone, but a lot of us do. So sitting there and going, you know what you should do is not the first step. The first step is, I'm really sorry you're feeling like that. How are you feeling? Nothing you can tell me is off limit. Like, actually have the maturity to sit with what I call with the kids, the big feelings. Validate the feelings. Don't gaslight the person. Oh, if you went for a jog, you'd feel better. Well, you don't know that.
I definitely wouldn't. I'll tell you that for now.
And I definitely wouldn't. Right? Over time, are diet and exercise really good for your mental health? Absolutely. Pissed off. Wish it wasn't true. Is. But if you're dealing with a person in the middle of a panic attack or depressive episode.
Just go for a run.
Seriously. You know, like, what would you do with someone with a physical condition? You wouldn't kind of go, oh, your hand's burning. Just pretend, you know, that it feels all right and like wave it around in the air. No, you need some help. You need some help and validate what they're going through. And I think for a lot of people, not for everyone, it's really different depending on the depth of the depression or anxiety you're in. And it also depends other conditions, you know, schizophrenia, for example, bipolar, a whole range of conditions that we don't talk about enough. Just sitting and listening might not be enough.
Yeah.
But geez, it's a good place to start, isn't it? Rather than being told, well, you know what I would do? Have you tried turmeric? Have you had a turmeric latte? Oh, does anything enrage you more than when you tell people you've got anxiety and they tell you to bloody meditate?
I keep getting it from my psychologist literally keep saying, the anxiety means that I can't.
Can't. I've been breathing for 47 years. And you know what? What I would say to you based on what you said to me before, Louise, go and watch the MasterChef, babe.
Hey, I've been watching Too Hot to Handle this week, and that is just as brainless.
Too Hot to Handle? Do you know what I mean? Like, whatever, you're not going to get anybody judgy eyes. You know what actually helps you.
Yeah.
One of my carer mates, so I do these carer gigs once a month, and some of these people, the wisdom, I tell you, because the lives that these people have lived, when we were talking about self-care, which is a big thing that I could bang on about for a long time, but she said, because I confessed to her, I'm a bloody women's health ambassador during lockdown. Down there was a point where I was sitting in the shed drinking gin and secretly smoking to hide from my children. Right? That's the point that it got to, right? And I said to her, so what would you say? And she said, I would say choose the least harmful option. So if you were thinking you were going to sit there and have 3 gins and 10 cigarettes, have 2 gins and 5 cigarettes. And I went, oh, my God, you're the best. Because what happens if she had gone, Nellie, you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be drinking and you shouldn't be smoking. I already know that.
Yeah.
That's why I'm confessing it like I'm talking to the Pope, you know. Or, oh, well, you've eaten a whole block of chocolate. She's like, well, then eat half a block of chocolate. You know, to me, choose the least harmful option. Choose the least worst option. That's some good advice for mental health.
I'm going to get it printed up on a T-shirt.
Let's get bloody stubby holders.
Yeah. Choose I'm going to go and have some M&Ms.
Only half the bucket, Andy.
But, you know, if you know that sitting down, eating M&Ms and watching, you know, The Good Fight is going to calm you down, maybe watch 2 episodes instead of 4 and eat half the bucket instead of the whole one.
Yeah.
You know, don't aim for this, oh, okay, I'm going to book myself into a 14-day Vipassana, because you're not going to do it.
Wait, what is a Vipassana?
I probably got the word wrong.
Is it like one of those silent talk? Is it like a silent thing where you can't talk for 2 weeks?
You're not allowed to talk. And they get you up at 5 o'clock and give you, you know, a third of a cup of porridge.
That reminds me in the Eat, Pray, Love when she goes. She goes in the pray and she spends 3 months in an ashram, and I'm like, but why?
Yeah, no, Elizabeth, calm your farm, mate. You're in Bali.
3 months.
Get yourself to Kuta and get a Mai Tai.
Enjoy the view.
Seriously, enjoy the view. But you know what, Andy? If that, and this is my thing, I mean, we joke about it, but it's true. If that sounds like it worked for you, great. Mm. I think the problem for people like me and Louise is that that's the default setting. That's the kind of, here's the 101. You should do meditation. Mm. You should do yoga. You should do it. That does not work for everybody.
Absolutely.
And constantly telling you that that's what you should do is honestly a form of gaslighting.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if the meditation itself is what attracts me, more so just removing myself from society. I think that's the winning card.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get that. And actually my hot tip around meditation, because I bloody hate meditation, I've tried it for so long, I now do the tapping, you know, the EFT tapping. And I think it's basically meditation, but with tapping. And I think the reason it works for me is because it's active.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So I've actually got a process, you know, I have to do something rather than the idea of laying down and just breathing literally gives me anxiety,
you know, whereas sleep.
Oh, right. Well, I would do it if it would send me to sleep.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, right.
This is why we don't sleep, Andy. Nelly, what's your sleep like? Because mine is shit.
Oh, Max. I haven't slept since the late 80s. You know, like when they would talk about sleep deprivation with kids. And I'm like, when were you people sleeping before?
What do you mean everybody doesn't want to suddenly start learning about that cave diving incident of 1987 at 2 in the morning? And then they go in. Then they go into a 30-page long form article from the New Yorker.
Do you know one of my favorite jokes, and I'm not going to do the whole joke because it would bore the crap out of everyone, but I used to do a joke about this exact thing where I would start thinking about winning lotto and then I'd start thinking about how to divide the money and who I would like give it to. And it got to the point where I would be setting up my own NGO, but worrying about the tax status, right? And worrying that it's undermining the welfare state and all this kind of stuff. And of course, the punchline being, I don't even buy lotto tickets. But to me, this is like a perfect encapsulation of the anxiety brain of just kind of going, it doesn't have to make sense.
No.
It's perfectly logical. And once I'm on that train, toot, toot, Nellie's not getting off.
This has been fantastic, Nellie. I'm so appreciative of the time that you've given us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me and for, you know, as they say, fighting the good fight. The more talking about this stuff, the better.
Absolutely.
Yeah, really glad to have spent some time with you today and that you got off the train long enough for us to have a chat.
Yeah. Well, and you know, this is another thing we need to talk about, don't we? Like, I'm in a pretty good period at the moment. That's another thing we don't talk about with mental health.
Yes.
It's like, you know, it's not all the same all the time.
No.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm good, and I'm pleased to be able to talk to you both.
Nellie was so generous with her time and story. You know, we're super, super grateful for all that advice that she gave us.
Yeah, look, she really helped me, and I'm sure she helped you as well to realize that there's value in letting that stuff that we typically find negative and run away from to exist so that, you know what, we can face it and we can do something with it rather than treat it with a platitude band-aid or whack ourselves over the head with it.
Oh, I think we've whacked ourselves over the head plenty of times now about how long it's taken to air some of these interviews or even that big gap that we might have had between episode 34 and 35.
Let's just call it a 2-month sabbatical.
The beauty of evergreen content is that people binging it will never know that episode 35 sat on Louise's to-do list for 2 months.
While Andy wrote 3 episodes ahead.
And then the irony, of course, being, and we've said this many times in the series, is that it's like this series is art imitating life, imitating art, imitating life. So when we recorded these interviews originally last year, they were really relevant to us at the time, and then they helped us move through things. Then we put the storyboards together and these situations kept coming up in our lives. And then we have been recording these episodes in between the episodes and the top and tails for the episodes around that. And again, we're finding that we're dealing with some of the same issues that we were dealing with at the same time we recorded some of these episodes. So when Nellie tells us that we need to stop whacking ourselves over the head with things and actually not run away from the negatives.
You know, it's almost like we've learned nothing.
Yeah.
But we have. We've taken a lot from it.
We're at the end of episode 36 and life is a circle.
That's right. Same patterns. But we've definitely, if we look at ourselves now compared to 12 months ago, we are definitely in a much different, better place, I think, individually and collectively.
Speak for yourself. That's why we need to keep going and talk to someone else next episode. But cheers to Nellie Thomas, though.
Cheers to you, Nellie Thomas, because, you know, you learned and showed us the value of zero fucks. But we'll reserve one or two fucks just for you because of the impact this conversation has had on us.
You know, jokes about our sabbatical aside, our two-month sabbatical aside.
Yes.
And art imitating life, imitating art, imitating life. I certainly feel like in that last two-month period that, you know, my mental health hasn't actually been as good as what I would like the storyboards to show that it has.
Mm.
And I've felt a lot of negativity and negative emotions creeping in and suffocating. So maybe we should explore those in more depth.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about art imitating life, imitating art, imitating life. I just want to precursor and say that we have got an episode coming up in a couple of episodes' time called Tear It Down and Build It Up Again. So
no, I don't want to tear anything else down. I'm
completely not ready for that.
So next time on Reframe of Mind, we'll hear from Dr. Lisa Salzman, Senior Lecturer at the University of Western Australia and Senior Clinical Psychologist at the Centre for Clinical Interventions of the Western Australian Department of Health. If she can't sort me out, who can, Andy?
Well, she's going to join us with some other guests to see if we can, and we'll dive a little bit deeper into the value of perceived negativity.
You can bring new perspective to any experiences, whether they be past experiences and how we've understood or reflected on those and what we've taken away from those. I do think from an evolutionary perspective, our mind was built to find the bad stuff. You know, actually, that's our mind's design, is to look for threat, to look for the negative, to look at what might go wrong to protect ourselves.
You've been hearing our story. Now we really want to hear yours.
Connect with at Reframe of Mind on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok and Twitter.
Or connect with at Welcome Change Media on LinkedIn.
You can also contact us via reframeofmind.com.au with your stories or suggestions for future topics.
We'd like to thank today's guests for sharing their personal stories and insights. And for more information on any of the subjects, guests or references used in this episode, please see our show notes or reframeofmind.com.au.
Reframe of Mind is a Welcome Change Media production.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Democracy is hanging on by a thread, and misinformation is everywhere. I'm a political analyst and columnist, Danielle Moody.
And I'm writer Wajahat Ali. And we've come together to lead you away from the lies and out of the gaslight.
This is Democracy-ish.
Black and brown people already knew that there were multiple levels to our justice system, to our injustice system.
And I think those of us who are willing to be nimble and flexible and stretch into being something new, I think we will be the ones who might emerge in a healthier, better way moving forward.
We discuss the serious issues and threats that face our nation. Join us on Democracy-ish everywhere you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.